6-0651, Richard Voltaggio versus Carol Yasko. Representing the defendant, Carol Yasko, Mr. Friedman.
May it please the court, my name is James Friedman. I represent the defendant appellant in this matter, Carol Yasko. Ms. Yasko is also in attendance today, and seated with me at counsel table is attorney Robert Drebs. This case is not just about the judicial process. It is about the democratic process. An absolute privilege against defamation liability is necessary to promote the critically important public policy of encouraging citizens to take part in the legislative process. But if this court refuses to apply this absolute privilege here, the threat of harassing lawsuits for defamation will undoubtedly deter citizens from participating in government, will promote litigation, and will inevitably result in less informed decision-making by our elected officials. On October 18, 1994, the Whitewater City Council met to discuss a committee's recommendation to use a former middle school for city offices. The council invited Ms. Yasko and other neighboring property owners to attend the meeting and testify on the proposal. Ms. Yasko accepted the invitation and did what few citizens have the time or the passion to do. She took an active role in the democratic process. She is not a lobbyist nor a candidate for public office. She is merely a concerned citizen and homeowner, someone who cares about her community. During her testimony, Ms. Yasko noted the destabilization of her neighborhood as it transitioned from single-family housing to college student housing. And she criticized the upkeep of several buildings owned by the plaintiff respondent, Richard Voltaggio. Finally, she urged the city council to accept the proposal to use the vacant middle school building in her neighborhood for additional city office space. And for acting as a concerned citizen and expressing her views on this issue of substantial public importance to the people in Whitewater, Ms. Yasko was sued for defamation and now faces a jury trial.
What does his being a no-good landlord have to do with the reconditioning of this building? Part of the reason you have to have for the privilege is that it's related to the subject matter that's being discussed legislatively.
Absolutely, Justice Steinmetz, that's correct. There are basically two prongs that must be established to fit within the absolute privilege. The first is that the statements were made as part of the legislative proceeding. There is no debate about that. Mr. Voltaggio actually alleged as much in his complaint. The second...
Suppose that Ms. Yasko had called one of the city council people. Instead of appearing in a public hearing, what about that? Would that be privileged?
Your Honor, if it had some relation to the proceeding, then yes, it would be privileged. To quote the Restatement Second, Section 590A, a witness is absolutely privileged to publish defamatory matter as part of a legislative proceeding in which he is testifying or in communications preliminary to the proceeding if the matter has some relation to the proceeding. So yes, in that situation, if there was a proceeding, an ongoing proceeding, it would be absolutely privileged. Getting to Justice Steinmetz's question, that's the second prong under the restatement test, and that is that the statements must have some relation to the proceeding. Now, this is not legal relevance. This court has said explicitly that all doubts should be decided in favor of relevance.
Mr. Friedman, who makes the determination of some relation? Is that a jury question? Is it a question of law to be determined by the court?
That is absolutely a question of law, and this court has found that in several cases applying other privileges with the same basic test. The judicial absolute privilege, for example, and the absolute privilege for witnesses testifying before quasi-judicial bodies.
Is that clear in the discussion of the restatement itself, or are you drawing that from the Wisconsin cases on the judicial absolute privilege?
Justice Crooks, I believe that the restatement says that explicitly. In any event, as I just stated, this court has said that applying basically an identical privilege from the restatement a couple sections earlier, this court has actually adopted every single section of the restatement of torts that has to do with liability when it was presented with that section of the restatement. And in so doing, as to these absolute privileges, this court has found that the sum of relation to the preceding prong is a question of law. That's really the key to this whole case, because if that was a factual question, as a conditional privilege would present, then citizen witnesses would face jury trials on these fact issues, and the threat of a jury trial would intimidate them and prevent them from testifying.
So if we're a conditional privilege, then in fact it would be a question of fact.
The conditional privileges raise questions of fact as to whether there has been an abuse of the privilege. And so there would likely be a jury trial in this case and in many other cases.
But would the relationship requirement also be an issue of fact then?
No, it's absolutely an issue of law, and this court has said so. I believe I can get you a cite for that. I believe this court said so as far back as the Busowitz case of 100 years ago. More recently, the Court of Appeals said so in Rady versus Lutz. But I don't think that will be an issue when the court reviews the jurisprudence from this court and from our Court of Appeals that we have cited in our briefs. It is clear that the sum relation is an issue of law, whereas whether there has been an abuse of a conditional privilege is an issue of fact. And that is why Mr. Voltaggio's suggestion to adopt a conditional privilege only is just not enough. Citizen witnesses are still going to be scared about facing a jury. They are still going to have to expend tremendous amounts of time, effort, energy, and of course money on attorney fees.
I was going to ask you, it concerns me a little bit about just the control, the supervision over these witnesses. Now, as I read this record, this witness was one of many, came in and read, as I understand, a prepared statement. This was not a question and answer. And if we extend this to legislative bodies such as the Whitewater City Council, this means, I'm assuming, town boards, anyone that comes in and testifies. And I would just ask you, isn't there a concern about controls? How does one, what is sufficient supervision? I've attended many of these meetings in both capacities, city councils, town boards, and I don't, as I recall, I didn't see the supervision that would exist if it was a judicial hearing where you have the, if you defame, if you falsify your testimony, you have the threat at least of perjury. Here there's nothing. You can say, if we have an absolute, if you meet the two prongs, you can say almost anything you want and not be concerned about that.
Justice Wilcox, I would answer that in a number of ways. First of all, there is no evidence suggesting that in the multitude of jurisdictions that have adopted this absolute privilege and that apply it to lower legislative bodies, as you are concerned about, that there has been any such abuse of this absolute privilege. Second of all, I believe the prong pointed out by Justice Steinmetz, the sum relation to the matter, is going to help prevent any such abuse.
Well, what was the relation here?
I believe the relation was quite clear, Chief Justice Abrahamson. The city council was talking about a recommendation about how to use a vacant middle school in Ms. Yasko's neighborhood. Ms. Yasko's entire testimony is a description of her neighborhood and how it is no longer single-family dwelling, and that the city council should not be concerned that they're changing a family neighborhood into a business neighborhood. In addition, she mentioned that, look, the buildings in our neighborhood are in horrible shape. It would be very nice to have a beautiful city office building with a park around it to help revitalize my neighborhood. That was her testimony in a nutshell. Clearly, there is some relation
to
the...
Okay, so what I was saying was nothing defamatory in what you just said.
Your Honor, in describing the dilapidated state of some of the buildings, Ms. Yasko referred to the buildings with such language as calling them pigsties.
Particularly the plaintiff's buildings.
Particularly the plaintiff's, although she did mention, I believe, two other non-resident landowners.
What if she'd gone on to say everybody that rents in that building is a sexual predator and it clearly was not true? Immune?
Again, Your Honor, the whole point of the absolute privilege is if citizens have to dissect what language that they use, they're not going to testify.
So it's related. Your point is that it's adequate and related as a matter of law.
Something like that would likely be, it's a question for the court to determine, but if the point was the same as Ms. Yasko's, that this neighborhood is in horrible disrepair and it needs something like a city office building to help it out, then yes, there's a good chance that that would have some relation.
Now, if the other side could show that she had, and I have this record, had a personal vendetta against the person she's speaking about, she has got lawsuits against them, she's had problems with them, and she comes ostensibly to talk about the middle school and says exactly what she says and makes another, no matter, even if you could prove ill intent, your position is she's immune from suit.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And again, because intent is going to be too much of a fact-based determination, and therefore it's going to subject people like Ms. Yasko to jury trials, and it's going to deter them, have a chilling effect on their testimony.
But isn't that a really heavy price? So if you can prove or have a relationship, then you basically can say anything you want about anything at that meeting. So, and that's why I have some concern over the absolute privilege, because as Justice Geske indicates, once you get over the two-prong test, then it's carte blanche. And if there is a personal vendetta, then the person that is defamed has no redress whatsoever, none whatsoever.
I would take issue with your last statement, Justice Wilcox. There are still other avenues of redress, not civil lawsuits.
Such as?
The person defamed can attend that city council meeting and speak in rebuttal.
But this person, okay, let's just take this. In this case, the person never knew. I mean, this was, as I read this, it's kind of out of the blue because no one had complained about his properties. And that's what I'm referring to. You'd have to have some notice where the person that had the possibly would be there to defend himself or herself would know. But and that isn't the case under absolute immunity.
You're correct, Justice Wilcox. There is no notice requirement. No court in the country, as far as we know,
right,
suggests there is. Again, I will answer this in two parts. First of all, there are other avenues. For example, testifying at the same or a later legislative proceeding to rebut the testimony. Second, there are letters to the editors. There are letters to city council members rebutting it. In addition, what I was starting to say before, even though there is not as much control as in a judicial proceeding, there is still someone running the meeting. That person has both the authority and the duty to keep some control, to keep the testimony related to the subject matter.
Let me ask you, in response, take this to the next level. Let's assume the person does respond by writing letters saying, the person who spoke to you is a liar and I've known her to lie 15 times. Is that subject to a defamation suit?
It may well be. Again, it would have to fit within, in order to get the privilege, it would have to have some relation to the proceeding. The statement would have to have some relation to the proceeding, and the statement has to be made.
Does the proceeding continue to expand in relevancy in this sense of whatever the speakers say, then other people can rebut it, and all that's immune? I mean, it seems to me that if he would respond and say, she's a liar and she's done blah, 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 he's no longer talking about the middle school.
And Justice Geske, that would be a question of fact for a court to determine whether the response is indeed within the privilege.
The legislative proceeding may be over. That night, the Whitewater City Council decided to either grant or not grant whatever it was they were asking. So the proceeding is done. Now the only time that there's a question.
He reads the next morning in the newspaper that he was defamed and he wants to respond.
Right. Exactly. So you're out of the first prong.
In that situation, you're correct. However, there would be at least a conditional privilege because this would be...
Okay, let's talk about the conditional privilege. Well, what are the elements? Does it have to be part of the legislative proceeding?
Your Honor, the bottom line is in this setting, no court has adopted a conditional privilege for witnesses.
No, but suppose we did. Just generally, what is a conditional privilege? Would it have to be part of the legislative proceeding?
It would probably, the first prong would probably be about this. Actually, both prongs are probably the same, and then the next question is, was there an abuse of the privilege? And there's a number of ways that the defendant can abuse the privilege.
And the abuse is generally under the rubric without malice, is that it?
That would be one of the prongs of the...
What does that mean?
Excuse me, without...
What does without malice mean?
To the extent it has the same meaning as in the First Amendment context, then it would mean that with knowledge of the falsity or with reckless disregard of the falsity of the statement.
What are the other ways of showing conditional privilege?
I would have to refer to Mr. Voltaggio's briefs on that issue. Your Honor, the bottom line here is that a conditional privilege is going to apply in any event. Mr. Voltaggio has admitted that there is a conditional privilege for two parties talking about a subject matter of common interest. Because of that, we have made no effort to find out what the abuse of the conditional privilege is, because that's a fact question. It hasn't come up yet.
I have another question for you. What legislative proceeding were we talking about? Here it was a city council. Suppose it was a zoning board, which is sort of quasi-legislative, quasi-judicial.
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that the zoning board was acting in a quasi-judicial capacity, then this court has already said that the absolute privilege applies. If it's acting in a quasi-legislative or a legislative capacity, then the common law out there unanimously would say that, yes, this should apply to witnesses before that body, even though it be a subordinate legislative body.
So if I get the answer to your question, there isn't any legislative body that would not, if we were to accept your position, that would not be covered by absolute immunity.
Absolutely, it should be any legislative body. And
or quasi-legislative.
Quasi-legislative, obviously, is not an issue right here, but to the extent that quasi-legislative means that it borders somewhat on the judicial end, then certainly the same privilege should apply. This court, as you know, have adopted the privilege for judicial proceedings,
right,
for quasi-judicial.
Know, you've taken us now from the state legislature to a city council to every board, commission, etc., delegated from the city council down.
Right.
Is that what you're doing?
Yes, Your Honor, and the common law out there suggests that is the case. In fact, this privilege has been applied specifically to the House of Representatives, to state legislatures, to city councils as here, to county boards, subunits of county boards, and even to a community college board. What generally is the case is that these boards get their power from the state legislature, and that, I imagine, is the case here. The Wisconsin statutes give city councils their authority, and so therefore they come within the rubric of this absolute privilege.
Does this have anything to do with home rule, then?
To the extent,
constitutional.
Yes, to the extent that that's where the legislature, the legislative body, gets their power, yes, it would.
I have another question for you. What if this, I gather here that Ms. Yasko was invited to participate, and then she got noticed because she was a neighboring property owner. Suppose that she wasn't invited, suppose she lived on the other side of town and had limited interest other than a citizen of the community in this project. She still get the privilege if she comes all the way across town and defames. We agree that these comments are defamatory.
No, we agree only that they have gotten by the motion to dismiss stage in the trial court. The trial court has not been faced with that issue. That is clearly a fact issue that will come up later if this court does not apply the absolute privilege.
Let's say she says the same thing that Ms. Yasko said.
Your Honor, the courts and commentators who have applied, adopted this absolute privilege have found that it does apply regardless of whether you are subpoenaed or invited or do it on your own. The bottom line is, now to answer the second half of Justice Wilcox's question, the courts have determined, as I hope this court does, that the public policy in favor of having citizens participate in government without concern for civil liability is more important than the potential for abuse. And that is why it doesn't matter that there's not as much control, and that is why the absolute privilege applies regardless of whether the witness is under oath, regardless of whether the witness is subpoenaed or appears voluntarily.
Mr. Friedman, I need to have clarified, for my purposes at least, what the trial judge actually ruled here. Did you argue both an absolute privilege and a conditional privilege, and the trial judge found no privilege at all?
No, Your Honor. It's a little bit more confusing. Early in the case, co-counsel moved for summary judgment or dismissal on an absolute privilege and unconditional privilege, suggesting that the undisputed facts showed that there was no abuse of the privilege. We then moved for reconsideration, showing the court the vast body of case law suggesting that absolute privilege should apply. At that point, the trial court had not seen this absolute privilege case law. The absolute privileges were argued as an extension, basically, of the quasi-judicial. The trial court, in a second hearing, basically, on the motion for reconsideration, found that the absolute privilege has not been adopted yet in Wisconsin, and the trial court did not feel it was the appropriate body to do so, and did not touch again the conditional privilege issue. The judge had previously found that there were fact issues, and so summary judgment was not appropriate on that issue.
So it came up on a leave to appeal, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. We appealed the non-final decision denying the motion for reconsideration.
And that was so that there was no final, no absolute privilege. That's the legal issue.
That's correct. That is the sole issue before this court. It's the only issue that we have argued starting with the motion for reconsideration.
And should the court find in your favor, then your position is it has to dismiss the complaint because it's a question of law and we can decide the law on the basis of this record.
Absolutely. There is no legal reason to remand, and certainly nothing in the record here would suggest that a remand is necessary. As I suggested, this court has, and I do have the citation now, Snow versus Keppel, 159 West 2nd 77 at 81. This court suggested that the sum relation to the preceding prong is an issue of law, and that follows Busowitz from 100 years earlier.
But that's not in a legislative proceeding, that case.
No, it's not, but I believe the language is identical. This court has adopted basically the restatement second of torts on both judicial and quasi-judicial, and it's one of the two of those.
Counsel, you're asking us in your brief on page 12 and 13 to adopt the restatement 598. If we would agree with your argument, what's the advantage of adopting the specific restatement as opposed to just extending common law?
Absolutely none, Your Honor. If this court were to extend the common law as it now applies to judicial and quasi-judicial proceedings, the result would be identical. We only suggest that the restatement that this court has in the past specifically adopted language from the restatement. The restatement concisely explains the privilege, and many other courts have, when reviewing this issue, looked to the restatement for its language. The language from Busowitz, all down the line, Bergman versus Hoopy, Snow versus Keppel, et cetera, would be fine. And I would like to point out, once again, since I think it's only about a sentence in our briefs, this court has recognized the absolute privilege for legislative proceedings in Zinda versus Louisiana Pacific Court. This court specifically stated that absolute privileges are applied to legislative proceedings. Now, Zinda was not about a legislative proceeding, nor was it about an absolute privilege at all. This court was merely going through the state of the law. But this would not be a radical extension, but rather just adopting what you've already said before.
Mr. Friedland, what are the protections against reckless abuse? I can envision a lot of protections against abuse in a judicial proceeding. You've got a judge there who's used to this kind of thing, who can control witnesses, etc. I've seen a lot of legislative hearings in my day outside of Madison that can get awfully wild. And if we give the absolute privilege, then a witness is, so long as it's related to the proceeding, somehow, at least from what I hear you saying, it can be a very, very insubstantial relationship. The press is then free. The newspapers and radio and television are free to repeat those statements. And as you know, as we all know, the old saying, you know, a lie or slander travels halfway around the world before truth gets out of the gate. What do we do about reckless abuse, then?
Justice Babbage, I would point again to some of the things I've mentioned before. The sum relation does bring it within the general context of the proceeding. Second of all, there's common sense is going to come into play. Ms. Yasko and other citizen witnesses are interested in having this legislative body accept their point of view. If their credibility is shot because they get up and testify about outrageous things which are easily disproved.
I agree with you. The facts are pretty antiseptic here. I mean, it's easy for me to agree with you on these facts. But what if Mrs. Yasko, for instance, were to have accused him of running a sexual
pornography shop or something, or abusing children within these buildings. And I mean, clearly that would have a relationship to the proceeding, even if she knew. But if she knew it was an outright lie, what's to stop that?
Justice Babich, I guess I would point to two things. One, there is no evidence of such abuse. As I suggested,
in this case, I know that.
I'm saying,
if we give an absolute privilege, counsel, how do we stop somebody from absolutely lying in an outrageous claim that can be repeated around the world?
I see my time is up. May I respond to the question?
Please respond.
When I suggested there is no evidence, what I'm saying is there are courts all around the country, federal and state at all levels, who have adopted this privilege, and we are not seeing outrageous abuse.
How would you see them if there's a privilege?
I imagine that the courts who have later adopted the privilege and have reviewed what happened in the other courts may have been presented with such evidence. Second, I will state again that courts around the country have recognized the fact that this privilege is necessary. The public policy of getting people involved in government, of getting them to participate in the legislative process, is more important than the potential for abuse, particularly because as to local legislative bodies, where else are they going to get their information but from the citizens who tell them, here is the state of my community? And if Ms. Yasko or anyone else has to sterilize their testimony, has to give milquetoast testimony and not even relate in the slightest bit, refer to any individuals who she might offend, then she's not going to testify.
What if I could prove, what if Mrs. Yasko were to accuse him of running a sexual, sex shop, and I could prove that Mrs. Yasko was deliberately lying? If we were to establish what you want, I understand there'd be no way that he could proceed against Mrs. Yasko. Is that correct?
Your Honor, it would be correct if it fits within the two prongs or the test that this court adopts, then the absolute privilege would apply. And the bottom line is there are policy decisions that have to be made all the time. We are asking this court to accept the fact that it's more important not to deter citizens from participating than it is to have the very occasional case of a great abuse of this privilege.
Well, what about an intentional infliction of emotional distress? Intentional interference with business activities, you would say that's all out on an absolute privilege?
The law is certainly not as clear on that issue. This court applied the privilege, I believe, in Zinda, beyond just the defamation context to I believe, invasion of privacy, which is often quite related. I cannot say that how courts have acted when there have been more peripherally related claims made outside the defamation context.
So there's a possibility other tort claims may exist.
There is. I don't want to concede that because we may come back and fight it if someone argues it. But the bottom line is the restatement refers to this as a privilege against defamation liability. Most of the courts that we have looked at say the same.
So this comes under defamation.
This comes under defamation. That is the only claim at issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Race, you represent Mr. Voltaggio.
Members of the court, Mr. Voltaggio, who is here today, I represent the plaintiff, Richard Voltaggio, and I'm the one who brought this defamation case. It was stated that the pleadings indicated that we'd only brought it as a conditional privilege of defamation. That's not true. It was brought both ways. There's no privilege in Wisconsin, and as though there may exist a conditional privilege, in case the court should have this board or a record board who has tossed one of the claims out, I had to fight it in both ways. The issue on October 18, 1994 was consideration of the Municipal Facilities Ad Hoc Committee recommendation to the Common Council to accept option 2B in addition to the public safety building with increased space for police and fire department. It was not about Richard Voltaggio's request for a rezone. It was not about zoning. It was not that Mr. Voltaggio served on that committee or even lived in the city. It was not that he had spoken that night and that there was something that Ms. Yasko had to respond to. He wasn't even there. How was he to know that his name was going to come up on this night and be spoken of in such a way? He didn't know and wouldn't have known. Not only was this at the city council meeting, but like many municipalities, there's a public TV station that broadcasts this and repeated broadcasts of this to the community. It wasn't just on this one occasion that these words went out. It was repeated and repeated and repeated to all the community of Whitewater, not a large community like Madison, but a small community of a little less than 10,000 people, where Rick Voltaggio is pretty well known. The other thing I'd like to point out is that she wasn't invited to speak. I don't think that makes a difference in your analysis of the speech, but she was not invited to this particular occasion. What she was invited to was to speak at the ad hoc housing committee that had occurred on August 29th of 1994. There's an exhibit in Mrs. Yasko's original motion that indicates that was where the invitation was. What this was a section that the City Council of Whitewater had for public input. And in that, she stood up and spoke and basically just blasted Rick Voltaggio. You've heard and seen some of the words, and although you talked about whether or not he was a sexual predator, he was accused of breaking other crimes, such as operating a pool hall in a residence, of violations of housing codes, that he operated a pigsty, that, I quote exactly, last year was a pool hall for pay that belongs to Richard Voltaggio. Proud owner of this slum property, it belongs to Richard Voltaggio. So she goes on in that sentence to call him a parasite of the university. Her very documents that she submitted to the court show that the very street she's talking about is directly across the street from the university. She doesn't allege that Mr. Voltaggio ever committed any violation of the zoning code. She's simply saying to this city council on this night, she doesn't like who her neighbors are, and she's blaming Mr. Voltaggio for it. And in her frustration, she's making accusations that we are claiming are totally false. There's no hue and cry in Wisconsin to create this privilege. We talk, I heard the question about, well, you know, if we do this, if we don't do this, we have to protect it. But since 74, there was the Richards v. Gruens case, which I cited. That was a 74 case, a defamation suit between a person who was claimed to be libeled by a council member and a city council. This court at that time didn't feel the need to create a privilege, and there's no need now. There's no need for any privilege, conditional or absolute, right now in Wisconsin. If there is a call for it, it can be created by a legislator such as in other states, but there's no need for this court to create such a privilege. Essentially, what she's asking you to do is to protect her name-calling and her lying to a public body. I think the strongest argument that I have to you is that there's no good reason to allow a person to call names in a proceeding like that. And you're right. I represent a town. I've prepared before zoning. The hottest matters that occur in those meetings are about zoning. Not in the courts about even such matters as divorce, which you think might be the hottest. But the hottest things in the world that I deal with are zoning matters and conditional uses in town boards and zoning hearings, etc.
But, Council, if there's not some kind of privilege, either absolute or conditional, haven't we seen time and time again, certainly in recent years, the ability of a moneyed interest to harass, intimidate, and even quiet criticism, both on a large-scale level, at least as documented in some recent stories in the New York Times about the Church of Scientology, or at a small-scale level?
Well, I don't think that is necessarily true in Wisconsin, because you've got to have some faith in the judiciary of the state to analyze the cases under 814.025 and that there may be frivolous and that there is no basis to them. In this particular case, we had Ms. Yasko on tape. If there is a moneyed interest that can bring on these lawsuits, I think you have to have some faith in not only the judiciary, but the lawyers of the state in not taking on frivolous matters where there's nothing there. I think there is room for public criticism, and there are avenues to approach this.
So your position is no privilege, conditional or otherwise?
Right. There's no need for it. She has redress, and I understand what the court's concern would be is, well, maybe Mrs. Yasko has a real problem here that needs to be addressed, and I don't doubt that. But we want her to pursue all means that are viable to her, not ignoring her concerns, but such things as perhaps calling the building inspector, talking with the police if she thinks that there's some illegal activity going on. And in the most important of all, which she never did, and the record shows that she never once contacted my client, direct negotiation, and perhaps as this court has looked at other forms of alternative dispute resolution, we should look at this situation and say, are you sure you want these people standing up at these meetings and just blasting their neighbors? If you create a sanctified area where any person can go into a meeting and just let loose, it's going to just create mayhem. And not only are you creating it for the participants in democracy, but also for those board members who may now have a conditional privilege, but they may have then an absolute privilege. If you want to talk about democracy and protection of it, I think it'd be best not to create any absolute privilege, because those town boards, those city councils, those library board members, zoning board members would then have an absolute right to blast the people in front of them. And I think you're creating a bit of chaos in these meetings, which are already difficult to handle. These witnesses were unsworn. They're testifying from their heart, from their soul. They're upset, and it would not be a good situation.
Mr. Reyes, isn't there a pretty legitimate argument that can be offered that we've already adopted the privilege, the language, and it's in the case would indicate that, would it not?
I don't think so, Justice. I think there was a question about what Judge Gibbs decided in Walworth County, and I believe that the order that I submitted indicates that they concede that the section has not been adopted by the state. That was in specific about meeting in front of legislative bodies, but I don't think that there was any direct finding by the court that such a conditional privilege exists, and I don't see it in the record right now.
You would say that the language in the Zinda case is dicta, basically?
It is dicta, sir. It doesn't directly talk about how a legislative body like a city council or a town board or even a library board and witnesses before those bodies should be addressed. And there's certainly nothing statutory that would protect the witnesses in this case.
Counsel, why wouldn't your... It's my understanding that 590 only goes to defamation if there's an absolute privilege. So why wouldn't your client, or maybe not your client, but others, be protected by other torts, such as interference with business, intentional infliction of emotional distress, negligent infliction of emotional distress, some other kind of tort, than defamation?
In those particular causes of action, such as you're talking about, intentional infliction of emotional distress, I'm going to have to show a different type of damage. I'm going to have to show that he did suffer emotional distress and had to be in some way treated for it. I mean, there's a clear line there. I don't believe I can show that necessarily in this case. The defamation goes to whether or not he's been lowered in the eyes of the community. There are two different areas of damage. The other one that you mentioned was the tortious interference with the business relationship. There's no showing necessarily that students won't rent from Mr. Baltazio in order to frankly mantle. I believe that I can show that at this time. There are different damages, different evidence that I would have to present. That doesn't mean that Mr. Baltazio was not lowered in the eyes of the community, and I don't want to leave that. I mean, people are bothered by this. This is a small community, and when people are spoken of in this fashion, it hurts, and it hurts deeply, and it is a real sense of damage. I think that's why defamation exists in Wisconsin as a cause of action. And Mr. Baltazio believes he was damaged and defamed after this meeting.
Tell me what the elements are of a conditional privilege.
Well, are we talking about, are you asking me about the abuse of the privilege or the...
Yes, either one.
I think that the Shannon, the Alliance for Mentally Ill, cites the five conditions under which the abuse of a privilege may exist, and it talks about defendant's knowledge of a reckless disregard of the falsity of the defamatory matter, that the defamatory matter is published for some purpose other than the one for which the privilege is being given, that a publication is made to some person not reasonably believed to be necessary for the accomplishment of the purpose, because the publication includes defamatory matter not reasonably believed to be necessary to accomplish the purpose, and that it includes unprivileged matters as well as privileged matters, are the five reasons cited in Shannon.
Your position is that it's an abuse of any privilege.
Yes, ma'am.
But you have to go back. You're not asking this court to hold in your favor on whether or not this privilege was abused. This should go back for trial.
Yes, ma'am. I don't think it's an easy decision in Wisconsin for a person to come to a lawyer and sit down and say, I've been defamed, I want to go through the expense of a lawsuit. This isn't a major corporation coming through and saying, we want to make sure that someone isn't speaking out against us. We're talking about two private individuals who are living their lives in a small community in Wisconsin. And they both have rights here, I understand that. Certainly Mr. Baltazio is not against free speech. but he doesn't necessarily want his name dragged through the mud or being accused of being a slumlord or a parasite. I mean, none of us would want that. He simply wants a Walworth County jury to consider whether or not he has been. And I'm not, you know, this isn't an easy case. I've got to go through the people on that jury to find the damages, if any, and to find whether or not Mr. Voltaggio has been defamed. That is not an easy road. And to suggest that there's going to be these thousands of cases if this case is made public and you don't create a privilege is just not true. Those are not easy steps for anybody. And they're certainly not going to be easy for me when I return to that courthouse. In closing, I just want to tell the court that really what I think the essence of her complaint was about landlords running to students in her neighborhood. And there's redress for that in other ways. She didn't have to attack Mr. Voltaggio in the fashion that she did. And specifically, in her statement, she said, "You're on the corner of Main and Witten Streets at the University of Wisconsin's front door." I don't think it should surprise her or this court or me or counsel that there are students living in her neighborhood. And that was the real problem, not Mr. Voltaggio. But she saw him as the problem. I think what you want her to do is seek means of redress, such as changes in the zoning law, questions to the building inspector, calling the police, or direct negotiation. You don't want to create this absolute right or even a conditional right now. It isn't necessary, and there's no need for it at all. Her statement was really not about the middle school. That she hooked on to the end, but it was about Mr. Voltaggio and those students. She took that frustration, she directed at my client, and I would ask this court to send it back and let the jurors of Walworth County decide whether or not my client was defamed and whether or not he should be awarded any damages.
Thank you, Mr. Race. Mr. Friedman.
I'd just like to make a few short points in rebuttal. First of all, Mr. Voltaggio's counsel has, for the fourth time now, brought up the Richards versus Gruen case. It would be hard to find a defamation case that was less on point. In that case, the defendant was a city council member, not a witness. More importantly, this court explicitly recognized that the defendant did not raise the privilege issue. Given this court did not address, let alone decide, an issue of privilege. The issue in Richards versus Gruen was whether the New York Times versus Sullivan First Amendment actual malice standard should apply because the plaintiff there was a public figure. This court has explicitly recognized the distinction between common law privileges as the one we are asking you to adopt today, which are based on the defendant's status as a witness, and the First Amendment standard from New York Times versus Sullivan, which is based on the plaintiff's status as a public figure. Second of all, a conditional privilege is just not going to be enough. A conditional privilege will not prevent slap suits, strategic lawsuits against public participation. Now, we are not arguing today that this court should address this case as a slap suit, but if there is only a conditional privilege, then slap-type suits are likely to arise more often in the future. Second of all, a conditional privilege is not enough because it's going to force the defendant to go and face a jury trial and expend tons of time and energy and money, and citizens are going to be deterred from taking part in the legislative process.
Let me ask you, because you've argued that there doesn't appear to be any problems in states where there has been a privilege, is there any evidence that there's been a problem in Wisconsin where at least this issue has not been directly addressed and it may have been unclear that citizens are afraid to go into legislative bodies and to testify, or that there's been defamation lawsuits filed, or is there any kind of evidence that it's been a problem?
Justice Geske, the problem is not the past. The problem is the future. Silence, as there has been other than the sentence in Zinda, is much better than a decision from the highest court in this state saying there is no absolute privilege.
But isn't there a problem either way? If you suddenly say, the decision says if there's an absolute privilege, as long as it's related, you can go to a legislative body and say anything you want as long as you can fall on the... Or the alternative, as your concern, is if there's no privilege, if there is no privilege, that people will be sued. So that's going to be a problem either way once we tackle the issue.
I believe the problem, common sense, I believe, dictates the problem will be much greater if this court comes down and says no absolute privilege. Then property owners like Mr. Voltaggio, business owners who have legislation pending that affects them, are going to be more likely to go to court, to have that threat of a slap suit sitting there. On the other hand, if a citizen in the community finds out that there is this absolute privilege, what are the chances a citizen is going to take the time and the effort?
What about citizens' groups trying to get out a public official, trying to have somebody either lose an election or be recalled, now seeing this as an opportunity to go to a legislative hearing on some issue that's slightly related to that public official's duties, and defaming that public official knowing the media will cover it?
Justice Geske, whether this court likes it or not, that is already subject to the First Amendment actual malice standard, which is, in 9 cases out of 10, subject to summary judgment rather than a jury trial. So there already is a protection there, whether you like it or not. We're not talking about that.
You're taking away any protection now.
I'm sorry?
By your argument of an absolute privilege, there's no protection.
It's a matter of degree. The bottom line is the First Amendment actual malice standard is such a high standard that it acts much closer to this absolute privilege than to a conditional privilege.
Mr. Friedman, correct me if I'm wrong in my notes. After listening to your initial argument, this is what I wrote to myself. For purposes of deciding this issue, I have to decide whether intentional, outrageous, scurrilous lies are protected in a legislative hearing.
I don't believe I used...
That's notes to myself.
He doesn't remember that.
Have I framed the issue correctly for my decision?
That is not the way I would have framed it.
I know you would not.
I don't believe those were my words. Those were more likely one of your brethren's words. However, the bottom line, Justice Babbage, is we are suggesting that the better public policy choice is that any statements that are made as part of a legislative proceeding that have some relation to that proceeding should enjoy the absolute privilege.
So your answer is yes?
My answer is yes. I see that my time is up, and I thank the court very much.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Thank you, Mr. Race. The court is in recess until 1:30.